Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Hello my friends and welcome to the Elbphilharmonie Talk. Within our podcast series that we have here at Elbphilharmonie Media Tech, my name is Tom Schulz, and today I have conversed with Rune Tonsgaard Sørensen, who is one of the two violinists of the Danish String Quartet, quite a famous, young, wonderful string quartet that has quite its own sense of combining the classical repertoire of string quartets with very modern and even not yet written pieces of music, and have a deep love for folk music, especially for the Scandinavian folk music. And I hope you enjoy our conversation. So today I'm sitting here with Rune Tonsgaard Sørensen, and I'm not sure whether I pronounce your name remotely right.
So I think it was pretty good, actually.
Thank you. How would you pronounce it yourself?
Rune Tonsgaard Sørensen.
Oh, see. So it's Rune. It's not Rune, it's Rune to begin with.
Yeah.
So you are 1/4 of the Danish String Quartet, and I want to go right in the middle of the case of one of the cases, because I was under the impression you were like what they would call primarius in the olden days.
Mm-hmm.
What's your position in the quartet? Do you take turns?
We do. Yeah.
With Frederick?
Exactly, yes. We always did that. And I think it goes back to the very beginning where we met in this Danish summer camp.
When you were little boys, like...
Little boys,
11, like, 10, what was the age?
Yeah, something like that. I think I was there first time in 98, where I met the guys. At that time, I was 15.
Okay.
But, you know, early teens. And there we were just, you know, playing a lot of orchestra, but chamber music in the evenings. And the four of us found each other quite quickly. There was an instant personal chemistry and musical chemistry, and we had really good time together. And there was this little library at the school where they had, you know, all the material you could wish for. So we just went there and got all our favorite pieces. And even though we couldn't play them, of course, sight reading this is sometimes tricky, but we tried anyway. And
which were your favorite pieces, like Haydn or Mozart?
Yeah, of course there were some Haydn and Mozart there, but I remember especially the Ravel and Debussy. We quite ambitious. We tried to side read those pieces.
Oh, and great. Yeah.
And we never made it to the second line. It was always just the main theme, and then everything
done.
Messed up. Yeah, but at that time, of course, side reading for fun, we were switching chairs and trying both first and second violin, and then it's just been sticking to us ever since. And for us it works really well for many reasons, and one of them being obviously sometimes there is a bigger pressure on the primarius, the first violin. So to share that workload is nice. But you also get another feeling of the machinery in a string quartet when you play second violin and sit closer to the viola, for instance, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, it works for us.
I think it's also quite a modernist approach in terms of, you know, this top-down idea of
right.
a hierarchy. I mean, you are putting it so nicely in one of the liner notes of one of the Prism recordings. Hierarchies in Scandinavia are as flat as the landscape, so there is no big chance for anybody to superimpose his or her will upon
exactly.
the others.
So. Yeah, but I think it's a tendency in most chamber music groups nowadays. You know, before it was often a dictatorship in one way or the other, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's more turning towards, you know, democracies. So.
Yeah. So you have been playing a couple times in this hall here,
mm-hmm.
and once was even a blind date.
Oh, that's
right,
yeah.
It must have been quite something for you. I mean, to just explain that briefly, blind date is a format that we use like 3, 4, 5 times per season, not telling anybody, even not the people on the team, who is going to perform that night. And
right.
the audience is just open and trusts and thinks, well, it will be something that is worth, you know, attending.
Right.
But then this first second, when you step on stage and the audience, can you recall that moment, how that was?
You know, first of all, I was quite amazed of the turnout. I mean, there was a lot of people there, which means that they obviously trust the presenter here and this place, this hall. So that was my initial reaction. Just to see this full hall was just amazing, you know. I don't remember the exact reaction from the audience, if there was any. I just remember it was a very good night, and we loved playing in the hall. And as far as I recall, we also got to play an encore. So I guess that means that they at least liked what they heard.
They basically must have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I recall hearing you, if I'm not mistaken, it must have been in the what we call Nuller Jahre, like in between 2000 and 2010, in a beautiful place in a huge park in Hamburg, where you were presented as young artist, emerging artist at the, I think, Musikfestspiele Mecklenburg 4.0.
Ah, okay, yes.
It was quite intimate setting. People would dine, you know, and it was just like a sponsors and media and stuff. And back then, I must be honest, I didn't think of the Icelandic football team then, because it wasn't on the scene yet. But the appearance of you four guys, this Viking bravery, bearded, wild man kind of energy, totally transported.
Yeah.
And people were mesmerized. They loved you. They could hear how serious you were artistically and how young. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something you can still tap into. Is that right?
You might be right in that. I mean, we always had the same approach to making music, which is, of course, being professional and practicing and studying and, you know, all that needs to be done. But at the same time, we also try to be relaxed about it. I mean, it is something that we enjoy doing, and we enjoy each other's company very much. Which is, I think, is very important when spending so much time together as we do. You know, it's always a great fun to travel together and experiencing things together and make music together with people that you respect and admire and that can inspire you also. So I think we've been very fortunate in that way. And I mean, the Viking thing, I don't know who came up with that, because we just look like everyone else in Copenhagen, you know. But I guess, you know, it can seem a little bit unexpected to some people, and I mean, that's fine.
And it did bring really some fresh wind into this.
Yeah, but that's great. Yeah.
And of course, you're used to this kind of musicians from other areas like folk or pop music or jazz or whatever. And rootsy and earthy. I think it was a very healthy addition to the image of what a string quartet is.
Yeah. But that's nice to hear. We try always to keep our eyes and ears, you know, very open also to other genres, as you mentioned. See how other people are doing things. And I think it's very important to classical musicians nowadays to try to be open and listen out and be very broad in the way you approach your own music and your style and identity and brand, you might say also. So we get inspiration from many places.
How many percent of your time do you dedicate then for honing the brand Danish String Quartet?
Well, it's, you know, having a string quartet is basically also running a company. You know, there's so many things apart from playing the concerts and practicing. You know, tons of projects needs to be arranged, fundraising, social media, you know, you name it. There's so many things to take care of. And we are fortunate to have a great team of people around us that helps us with these things. But obviously, I think it is very important for all musicians to think about who you are and how you present yourself. So, I mean, it's not that every Wednesday we have a brand meeting.
Yeah.
it's not like
and
that.
And the board gets together right. And tells you, you have to wear this or that.
Exactly. It's not like that at all. But we just try to be true to ourselves and tell the story that's like about who we are. And that makes the brand, you know, I guess.
Yes. And it's so convincingly combined with its storytelling of the music itself. Mm. And I find that's obvious pretty much right from the start, at least from the start when you were beginning to record for ECM records, because even the first record already back then had a kind of a conceptual idea behind it.
Right.
You were taking pieces of Abrahamsen and Thomas Adès. Mm-hmm. And who was Nørgaard?
Yeah.
And that were all pieces that those guys composed when they were about your age.
Right.
More or less. So,
yeah. And that was all their first attempts on the string quartet genre.
Even that would combine these pieces.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, the story with this music for us also goes quite far back, because I remember in 2004, we did one of our first competitions. It was the Danish Broadcasting Corporation. They had like a chamber music competition back then. Chamber music was quite, you know, well presented in the radio back then, but now the competition is no more, unfortunately.
Oh.
But we participated in that edition, and in 2004. And I remember we had to pick, of course, a contemporary piece to play, and that was the Abrahamson that mm-hmm. we chose, because it just immediately spoke to us. And that's also how we choose repertoire nowadays. We only play music that really speaks to us and that we can connect with in one way or the other. The same was the case with the other piece on that album, the Thomas Addis Arcadiana. For listeners of this little show here, I can warmly recommend you to listen to that piece. That's absolutely stunning music.
Addis is stunning anyways. So,
my goodness, yeah. I mean, written in such a young age and just knowing so much about how to write for a string quartet, that's quite impressive. And making such an original and creative and wonderful world with these four instruments, it's just incredible.
Fantastic. So that was the first one, and then you moved on already to this folky Last Leaf.
Yes.
Which is maybe also a kind of a forerunner to what you are doing partly tonight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, playing, I mean, it's classical, the dances that you are doing.
Oh, yeah,
This approach to music as something even today you could dance to speaks to me very much. And I wonder, how did this come about? I mean, it's a collection, I should say this, it's a collection of folk songs and of composed folk music, right?
Right.
Partly arranged by yourself? Or
yeah, entirely arranged
entirely
and composed.
Arranged
Wow. The Last Leaf is, And you touched on it, but that was actually the inspiration for us to create this dance suite, because we just started talking about the symbiosis between music and dance, you know, that has existed since the very beginning almost.
Totally.
And how, you know, almost every Baroque composer, you know, used the dance suite as a musical form. One of the most well-known, of course, being Bach. And, you know, it was one of the most predominant musical forms back then. So we thought, why not see how, you know, what can we do with this musical form? Can we change it up? Can we make it relevant or make it sound different here in 2022? Because the concept is nice, you know. Dance and music have always been connected one way or the other. So that's what we did. So we have this musical form. It was typically 5 to 7 movements back then in the Baroque era. So we chose 7 movements of different eras. So it spans like 300-350 years almost, from French Baroque composer Charpentier until recent days, John Adams, living composer John Adams. He wrote this amazing piece called A Book of Alleged Dances. So are they real dances, or, you know, some of them actually sounds like it's would be really, really hard to dance to them.
Yeah.
Almost like trying to dance with a broken leg, you know, that's the feeling you get sometimes. But nevertheless, we took 3 of his movements and put it into the musical box here. Then there's one of our own arrangements of a traditional Swedish dance, and also a Saraband by a Russian composer, quite unknown, Felix Blumenfeld, who was mainly a teacher, but also was composing on the side. And he wrote this incredible, you know, super romantic, dark Russian Saraband, which, I mean, it's possible to dance to, but it's still nice music.
And it transcends kind of the dance. Like, I mean, the Say Solo from Bach also are suites, but of course you wouldn't necessarily feel compelled to dance to this music unless you're really a free spirit and find,
You know,
it's something to dance to.
Exactly, yeah.
Of course, I mean, I totally love this connection of music and dance, and I wonder, you know, sometimes you could argue, would it be like, what was first? Was it the melody or was it the rhythm?
Right.
And wouldn't the rhythm then necessarily lead to movement sooner or later?
Right.
And of course, also the melody can lead to movement.
Absolutely.
Both are very, very intriguing if they are calling the dancer within.
Mm.
And then there is this interesting kind of sarcastic quote in German, Musiker können nicht tanzen.
Mm-hmm.
So the musicians can't dance.
Okay.
And of course, want to know, does that apply to you? How do you rehearse such a jazz piece? Do you move to this at times? Or is it strictly musical and technical?
Well, it is strictly musical. I wouldn't know how to dance an Allemande or a Sarabande, to be honest. At the same time, though, I grew up with folk music, and I know the dances from that world. I mean, I know how to dance a waltz or a polka. See? Or a, you name it. Like, we have this slow 3 meter called a schottis in Denmark. So these dances I know, and I know what, you know, how good musicians are playing when they are playing for dancers. It's not necessarily the same as playing a concert. I mean, there are these folk musicians in Denmark who spend all their life playing to dancers, for dancers, and with dancers. And they have this amazing groove and swing that is just feels great to dance to. And you sense it immediately when you try to dance yourself.
And they are also responding to the dance.
Absolutely. It's a two-way communication. Yeah. Totally. It really is. Yeah. So that's very interesting, that, you know, what happens between the dance and the musicians, yeah.
But then even going a step further and saying, of course, nobody would expect you to dance an Allemande or a Courante because nobody really knows how that works. But you could use that music for kind of a freestyle movement, you know, just saying, this is, I dance on a regular basis because I know it does me good. It changes the way how I articulate musically.
Absolutely. And I think just... you know, movement, and, you know, we also use our bodies quite a lot and body language, you know, when playing. So I think it's a very big part of an experience, because an audience is not only listening. We know that ourselves when we are going to concerts, obviously, you know, sometimes you listen with your eyes, most of the time, actually, because, you know, this is the strongest sense that we have, is our vision and our eyes. So we hear what we see sometimes, you know. So this element of body language is incredibly important, you know, how you move and if it's connected to the music in certain way.
And it does change the articulation. I mean, there are musicians who would play up, standing up, you know, rather than sitting down. And even that already is a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes we play standing, but there are some reasons why we still sit down, but sometimes it can be really nice to stand up.
Yeah. Then you have this beautiful, multifaceted repertoire world going on. I mean, you are working on a series for ECM, Prism, which combines late Beethoven string quartets with some Bach and a 20th century piece, I would say, like Bartók, Shostakovich, Schnittke.
Yeah.
This is one ongoing project. You have released 3 out of 5 so far, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, yeah.
And at the same time, you are now doing this Schubert thing, what you call Doppelgänger, which is an interesting German word, by the way. Doppelgänger, meaning you are in the position now to commission pieces, which is wonderful. So the same Thomas Adès, whose piece you would perform 15 years ago, now composes for you.
Yes.
How do these ideas come about? I find them brilliant, but how do they come about? Is it a long discussion process, or is one person the leading ideas?
Yeah, well, I think it's a combination or a mix, you know. Sometimes one just gets an idea. Sometimes, you know, you read something online or whatever and it sparks something. You know, our viola player, Asbjørn, he's very good at connecting the dots and thinking these ways. So, you know, once in a while we meet up and we discuss what would be nice to play, any wishes from anyone, and then we see, you know, what makes sense here, and we try to create a coherent whole, a coherent project of these, all these different elements. And regarding the Prism project, you know, there was the Beethoven year of 2020, and that was celebrated in the whole world, not so much as anticipated, no, I guess.
Way less.
But we just managed to play a complete cycle in USA before everything shut down. But anyway, we knew that we were going to have a lot of Beethoven on the repertoire, and somehow we always connected mostly to the 5 late quartets. We felt it was, if not easier to play, then there was just a connection there that felt better to us than his earlier quartets. So if we should record something by him, it should be the five late ones.
Plus, you describe it so nicely in this liner notes I was referring to earlier, how kind of naive you were trying to sight read Beethoven late string quartets and how awful it sounded and what was needed in order to make music out of it.
Yeah,
and I can only say the music is really, really very moving and brilliantly played by you four guys.
Thank you. Yeah, but it is weird. I think it also shows when you play music that really does have an impact on yourself. It shows in the results when making music. I think that's my own personal take on
it.
But it is amazing music. At the same time, everyone plays the music, and so how do you actually make it your own? And that's the same case with the Schubert pieces. You know, it's so often performed. So that's the challenge sometimes I feel, trying to create a version that hasn't been heard before. And maybe also can be context-based, you know, because, you know, when you put Schubert music next to a piece by a contemporary composer, does that affect your experience of the Schubert? Or, you know, questions like that are interesting to us. So contextualizing our repertoire is important, I think.
Yeah, I think this is a key word for your entire recording plan, so to speak, contextualizing what you're doing. And it really goes way a step further than the Beethoven Bach Prism thing, which is beautiful in itself, because now it's not only you commission the composers to write a piece for you, but to reflect specifically on
a certain
Schubert work, you know.
Yeah,
so
it's
music about music, and it's music written for you.
Yes, yeah. We actually had the four composers choose themselves, and luckily, for some magical reason, you know, the puzzle just fit together in the end.
So that nobody took like twice the same.
Exactly.
Oh,
I have no
amazing
idea how that worked, but it turns out, for instance, with tonight's program, Bent Sørensen, who is one of the, you know, more celebrated living Danish composers nowadays, his first experience with Schubert was actually with the G major quartet when he was a young boy, and he felt, you know, so that was always his quartet. Tom Addis, he was not interested in writing another string quartet because he already wrote three or four, I think, but he thought that quintet sounded interesting to him. So he will pair the Schubert's quintet with two celli and write a piece for us.
Nice.
And then again, we have two female composers, Lotta Venikovsky, a Finnish composer who is then writing a piece that will be next to The Death and the Maiden. And then Icelandic composer Anna Torvaldsdottir will write a piece for that will be next to the Rosamunde Quartet. So it all worked out in the end,
magically,
even timing-wise, and, you know, with everybody's busy calendars and stuff. So, yeah.
So can we expect you to return with the three remaining Schuberts after this first night's performance here?
Yeah, if you want to.
You would.
We can be persuaded, I guess.
Yeah. For how many years is this project scheduled? I mean,
So the last Doppelgänger 4 concert will be performed in the 24-25 season. So it's a four-year project. So it all got a little bit messy with Corona, obviously. We should have premiered the first piece in Carnegie Hall, was it last year, and that got postponed. And so now, at the moment, actually, we are in a period where we're both playing number one and number two, even though we should only have been playing number two. But
because you played number one too little, so it needs
to be. And the co-commissioners around didn't hear the one yet.
I see.
So there's a lot of Schubert on the repertoire right now. So, but that's great. I mean, I
think it's not the worst composer you could choose for a
definitely
for a beautiful tour. So this is all wonderful. I think we're almost done here, and I still want to know from you, going back to the initial conversation about the dance and other styles of music and openness to other contemporary forms of music. Does that play a big role in your life? Would you occasionally go clubbing and dance to wild, different music, electronic stuff?
Probably clubs is not the place that we would go, but but still, I mean, if you would look at our playlists at home or CD collections or whatever, I think you will find a lot of different music. And this summer, actually, we're playing at Roskilde Festival.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, together
very
with...
Very famous Norwegian rock...
Oh, it's a Danish festival.
Danish Roskilde.
Yeah. So it's one of Northern Europe's biggest you know, rock, pop rock festivals. Yeah. But in fact, you know, they present, I think, 180 concerts in 4 days, ranging from hip-hop to pop to rock to classical to folk to world. I mean, everything is just represented there. It's just incredible. And that's... I love going there. I actually grew up in the town of Roskilde, so I've been there since I was a little kid. And of course, sometimes you go there because of a few artists that you know, and you're really looking forward to these concerts. But it's equally amazing just to go around to all these stages to experience music that you have no idea about.
To immerse yourself.
Yeah,
in
to immerse yourself. And very often you get really surprised and, wow, this is amazing. You know, here's a Mali orchestra, African band, or here's like a, it could be anything, you know, and just being open to all these things, I think it's important as an artist in general. And Roskilde Festival is just a place where you can get it all. So
in a very condensed form.
In a very condensed form.
Yeah. So could you name me two, three bands, musicians that have impressed you greatly?
Yeah,
recent times.
There's the amazing American mandolin player Chris Thiele.
Punch Brothers
and God Rodeo Sessions.
He's played solo in this recital hall you're going to be tonight.
Yeah. But we invited him also to Copenhagen to do a solo recital. It was one of the best concerts I've ever heard.
See.
Jesus Christ. But he's also just such an open and all-round musician. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can play everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely stunning. And then, you know, I've Gabriel Kahane, also wonderful. Obviously, I listened a lot to Radiohead before, all the Seattle grunge music.
Yeah,
I listened a lot to that. But now it's, I think I'm more, you know, towards probably the folk music nowadays. Oh, yeah, there's another Norwegian artist, Bernhoft. Do you know him?
I have heard of it.
Yeah.
I think he has even played here, Bernhoft.
Oh, yeah?
I think he has. Two, 3 years back during the, was it Alp Jazz or something?
Yeah, okay.
Multi-instrumentalist, he does it all by himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he was here.
Amazing R&B, like soul, fantastic voice, great bands, you know, yeah.
Good songwriter.
Good songwriter, really. So, and my little son, who is 7 months old, every time we put Bernhoft on, you know, he literally starts dancing. It's just incredible to see.
Wonderful. So, we don't have to make any assumptions that musicians, kids at least, can't dance.
Right.
Thank you so much, Rune, for your visit. It was been my pleasure to talk to you. Thank
Likewise.
You so much.
Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.